Hey, y'all. How's it going? Oh, that's good. Well, welcome to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, Scott Horton Show. It's a libertarian foreign policy, mostly. Today on the show, I think mostly it's going to be a surprise. I got enough invites out. I'm sure to get back some kind of positive response. Already, I got Stephen Zunis coming on to talk about Iraq, whatever. The war against the caliphate in the space formerly known as Iraq and Syria. So that's pretty good. I like Stephen Zunis. He's a smart guy. So there's that. And then also, I got a few more invites out in the email verse there. Some of which are sure to be read by the intended recipients, and then, you know, possibly maybe we'll get some sort of affirmative type of a reaction out of them. That's about all I can promise. I'm trying to get some more people on the show. All right. Well, I'm updating my status at liberty.me. I like liberty.me. It's a pretty cool thing, man. It's all right. I was interviewed by Jeff Tucker and by Angela Keaton at liberty.me, and I don't know whatever happened to that stuff. Will it post at some point? Are those videos already available? I don't know. But I could see it being possible, you know. I hope they do post sometime soon, those archives, before they're obsolete. But anyway, liberty.me, yeah. Also, you can follow me on Twitter if you like following folks on Twitter. I'm /Scott Horton Show. And then that way you can retweet all of my brilliant tweets. And also you can tweet things to me. Like, hey, Scott, did you see this one? Or, you know, stuff like that. Twitter.com /Scott Horton Show. Oh, you know what? I am falling down on the job so bad today. I have a whole section on the cops, and I had Will Griggs' blog open here so I could go back and read the last couple and invite him on the show. And then I started reading about African pirates, and I completely dropped the ball on inviting Will Grigg on. And it's probably too late with this short of notice now. Wow, this looks like a really good one, too. Might have to wait till next week because I've got no show tomorrow. I'm skipping out on the show. Ooh, I better call Ian on my hand here so I don't forget. I got to tell Ian that I'm skipping the show. Cool, well, all right. I got back a definite maybe there in the email. That's nice. I got to travel this weekend, and I got to leave tomorrow morning. So I will not be able to do a show tomorrow or the Sunday KPFK show either. So sorry about the delirium tremens there. I know it's tough sometimes going more than a day or two without listening to the show. But then again, there are 3,500 interviews in the archives at scotthorton.org. So that ought to keep you busy. You know, if you want to keep busy. All right. So Hassan Rouhani gave a speech to the United Nations this morning. And it was one part. Yeah, we hate ISIS too, and it's your fault for sort of kind of creating ISIS anyway. He was a little vague the way he said it, you know. And then he says, let's make a nuclear deal. So, I got a couple of things to say about that. First of all, any fighting that America does in Iraq against the Islamic State is de facto fighting for Iran. Again. just like George W. Bush did. Anything we do to the Islamic State is a blow for the Bada Brigade. For the Mahdi Army. For, I gotta sneeze. Asayb al-Haq and all the other Iranian-backed Shiite militias, and that includes the so-called Iraqi army, which is really nothing but the Bada Brigade anyway. And those guys are sick, evil, murderer, torturers, sectarians, really bad guys, the guys who made it this way in the first place. And to back them against the Islamic State is to back them against the Sunni population centers of the country. And that's assuming that they even have enough of their act together to even try to even entertain the possibility of crossing their lines into Sunni majority Sunni territory and invading those cities and driving the Islamic State out. I don't know if that's even possible, but really even anything that we do for them, just type in Soleimani in your Google images and your Google News, and you'll see that the leader of the Iranian Quds Force has been in Iraq. And I think he says this, or no, it was Trita Parsi on TV this morning from the National Iranian American Council was saying, Iran's been in Iraq fighting ISIS for 3 months now, which is true. Just another reason for America to stay out. Now, that does not make me David Frum or the New York Times, who only opposes war with the Islamic State because they are such pro-Israel traitors that they hate Iran so much more than these bin Ladenites that they would rather see the bin Ladenites continue to weaken pro-Iranians like Assad, Abadi, the Shiite militias, etc. And so, that doesn't put me in the same category with them at all, because, in fact, I'm all for peace with Iran. I am all for this nuclear deal. And, in fact, I am going to be so pissed off if they do not achieve this nuclear deal. And I think they're going to. I've been optimistic about this. Obama has got himself way out on a limb on this nuclear deal. And for him to fail now, well, he would just have failed at every single aspect of his entire life. He would be pathetic. He'd be as low as George Bush by the time he leaves power, not having accomplished anything but destruction. And so this has got to be his one thing that, you know, Nixon went to China, Obama, well, he ain't going to Tehran, but at least he's going to make a nuclear deal with Tehran. And the reason that's such a big deal is because, despite the fact that it's a fake issue, they're not making nuclear bombs. They never were making nuclear bombs. Everybody said they were making nuclear bombs was either lying or a damned fool. And it's a gigantic fake crisis. At the same time, it is the single biggest outstanding issue between the United States and Iran and any rapprochement between our two countries. Now, that can blow up in our face, right? I mean, leave it to the damn Democrats where peace with Iran, or, you know, the putting to bed of the last major issue outstanding. Maybe we'll get to real normalized relations much later on, but still, that just ain't good enough. They got to go ahead and ally with them and fight with them and turn back, redirect again back to the Iranian / Shiite side of the sectarian civil war going on in the land formerly known as Iraq. It's madness. It's horrible. God, it could have been Ron Paul, you know? He would have said to the Iranians, hey, I like how you guys are in the non-proliferation treaty. Please stay within the treaty and continue not making nukes. Okay, good. That's it. Peace, open trade, rapprochement, entangling alliances with none. Instead, Obama is going to be already is flying as the Iranian Air Force in Iraq. This is just going to blow up in all of our faces.
Hey, Al Scott here. Ever wanted to help support the show and own silver at the same time? Well, a friend of mine, libertarian activist Arlo Pignatti, has invented the alternative currency with the most promise of them all. QR Silver Commodity Discs, the first ever QR code 1 ounce silver pieces. Just scan the back of one with your phone and get the instant spot price. They're perfect for saving or spending at the market. And anyone who donates $100 or more to the Scott Horton Show at scotthorton.org/donate gets one. That's scotthorton.org/donate. And if you'd like to learn and order more, send them a message at commoditydiscs.com or check them out on Facebook at /commoditydiscs. And thanks.
All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. Coming up, Stephen Zunis on the war in Iraq. And I'm sure more. I just sent out a ton of emails this morning. Somebody else will get back to me, too. Lots to talk about here. I guess, let me go over the Iran thing. First of all, let me mention, Ian Freeman at, LRN.FM just sent me a message by way of Skype here. Satellite listener in Cameroon, Echo Yusuf, says, I love the Scott Horton Show, listen to it all the time. Thought I might like to know. Well, you're damn right, I'd like to know. And, hi, Echo. I don't know if you're listening live, but hey, man. That's cool to know that I got even just the one listener in Cameroon. I'm happy for that, man. That's really great. So, to everybody all around the world, welcome to the show. This is libertarian foreign policy from a Texan. That's basically what's going on here. Now, so here's the deal. The Iranian nuclear issue, they never were making nukes. All that hype you ever heard about the Iranian nuclear weapons program was false. All the suspicions, the completely trumped up ones, the forged ones, and the, that is kind of interesting. I think I might be a little bit suspicious type suspicions. All of those have already been asked and answered. And when you hear, oh, the IAEA says there's still some outstanding something, no, there's not. All that has been piece by piece, point by point, already completely debunked. The only thing of it is that the current head of the IAEA, Yukiya Amano, has disgraced all of his Japanese ancestors going back to ape times by getting down on his knees and saying, and it's in the WikiLeaks, thank you Chelsea Manning, it's in the WikiLeaks, that, hey, whatever my agenda is, just let me know, America. I'm your tool. You want me to go after the Iranians? I'll say whatever you want. I'll accuse them. Blah, 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 blah. Your wish is my command. I live only to serve you in dishonesty. It's all right there in the WikiLeaks. Yuki Amano. And he's just faking it when he pretends he's concerned. All these questions have been answered. And the final and complete and total debunking is in Gareth Porter's great book, Manufactured Crisis. And I know there are a couple of books on Amazon called Manufactured Crisis, but that's okay. Just add the word Gareth to your search or add the term Iran or nuclear. And there you go. Manufactured Crisis by Gareth Porter. He goes through point by point. Every fake suspicion and every genuine suspicion about what was really going on there, asked and answered. And in essence, the truth is simply what the Iranians have been claiming all along. And that is that they have a civilian nuclear program for electricity purposes. And they're not making nukes. Every bit of their uranium has been verified to still be right where it's supposed to be and not diverted. And that's even by the IAEA in the pocket of the United States, according to them. They have verified time and again, year after year, all the uranium's accounted for. There's really no question of any secret nuclear weapons program. That's ridiculous. They could never get away with that. Everybody would know and the U.S. would start a war with them. And really, there's no way for them to break out with the nuclear program, the civilian program that they have, and make a weapons program out of it without everybody knowing. Never mind any kind of an expanded inspection regime or anything else. Under the current inspection regime, under the safeguards agreement with the IAEA, under the Non-Proliferation Treaty, there's no way in the world they could make nukes without everybody knowing. And I'm not saying that that would be a legitimate casus belli for America to start bombing the country, but I'm just saying everybody knows that they would. And so really, if there is a foreign policy, a military deterrent to Iran's nuclear capability whatsoever. It's that very latent, really not even breakout capability that says, okay, you could bomb us, but at least now we've perfected enriching uranium. We figured out the fuel cycle. We know how to run the machines correctly. And so if you do bomb us, we could begin to try to make a nuclear weapon then at some point, because no one really imagines a ground army, invading Iran. That is just absolutely out of the question, even from the worst war hawks. All they want to do is bomb from the air. So it's a very kind of latent nuclear capability deterrent that, hey, if worse came to worse, because you guys made it that way, they could make a nuke. But in other words, they really don't have an ambition to make nuclear weapons, and the only thing that could get them to would be if America attacked them first. Meanwhile, they absolutely refuse to give up their quote-unquote unalienable right to peaceful nuclear technology, like in the deal, the Non-Proliferation Treaty that they signed, and which America is actually bound, and so is the rest of the UN Security Council, for that matter, as all nuclear weapons states and all signatories to the Non-Proliferation Treaty, we're bound to respect their right to peaceful nuclear technology. And in fact, according to the text of the NPT, we're all bound to help them with their peaceful nuclear technology, as long as they don't weaponize it. And anyway, so it's a gigantic fake issue, a huge manufactured crisis, as Gareth Porter puts it. And, I'll remain the number one proponent of a nuclear deal and a detente and peace with Iran, and the number one opponent of allying with them again in Iraq against the Sunnis and in that sectarian war, which they have done so much to help provoke. In fact, that's probably the worst thing that you could say about the Iranians and their foreign policies over the last, even since the revolution in 79, is that they took such advantage of that stupid little punk bitch, George W. Bush, and they sent Ahmed Chalabi to lie to the neocons and tell them war with Iraq would be good for Israel. And then the neocons told Bush it'd be good for America. And so Bush went and got rid of Saddam Hussein for the Ayatollah Khomeini, who then sent in his sock puppets from the Supreme Islamic Council and their Badr Brigade and the Dawah Party, and they came in and created the United Iraqi Alliance and got George Bush to kick all the Sunnis out of Baghdad at the cost of approximately 1 million lives in that civil war and give them southern Shiistan. The Iranians were the number one, along with the Israelis, I guess, but still, the Iranians were the number one opponents, and still are, of a single national, unified Iraq, based on Arab nationalism and Iraqi nationalism and compromise, rather than their brand of revolutionary Shiite sectarianism. And so, you know, if there's such a thing as hell, Khomeini will certainly burn in it for sending the Badr Brigade to torture and murder all the Sunnis and kick them out of Baghdad the way he did. And, of course, George Bush will just be his cellmate in there, his co-conspirator in the crime, his useful idiot. In no way should America be aligning back again with the Iranians in Iraq, although it's already started. It's already too late, but still. Well, it's not too late. We stop right now. Steven Zunis in a minute. Oh, John Kerry's Mideast peace talks have gone nowhere. Hey, I'll Scott Horton here for the Council for the National Interest at councilforthenationalinterest.org. U.S. military and financial support for Israel's permanent occupations of the West Bank and Gaza Strip is immoral, and it threatens national security by helping generate terrorist attacks against our country. And face it, it's bad for Israel, too. Without our unlimited support, they would have much more incentive to reach a lasting peace with their neighbors. It's past time for us to make our government stop making matters worse. Help support CNI at councilforthenationalinterest.org. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton, and this is my show, The Scott Horton Show, and I got Steven Zunis on the line. And oh, man, here's his bio. He is the professor of politics and program director for Middle Eastern Studies at the University of San Francisco. Welcome back to the show, Steven. How are you doing?
Very good, thank you.
Good, good. Very happy to have you back on the show. And let's see, the title here is The U.S. Should Use Caution in the Fight Against ISIL. That's your latest. Hey, let's start with ISIL. What is the damn deal with the acronym here? I mean, I know they call them Daesh in Arabic, kind of a slang term for them there, with their actual acronym in the language they're speaking. But over here, it seems like there was sort of a kind of a market discussion and choice in at least the media that we're going to call them ISIS. Even after they renamed themselves the Islamic State, nobody wants to say IS is or whatever. It's a painful way to write. So everybody calls them ISIS, except Obama and you. Still call them the Islamic State of Iraq and the Levant. What's the point of that? Or is there a point? Or what's the deal?
It's not really. In fact, I use it interchangeably. And I think if anyone's article you're looking at, it may be the choice of the editors more than what I originally wrote anyway. But
yeah,
basically, it's historically, Syria as a geographical region, as opposed to what we think of as Syria as carved out by colonial powers 100 years ago, is the area at the eastern end of the Mediterranean. And Levant is also the common term for that region, which would include Syria, Lebanon, Jordan, Israel, Palestine. So in other words, it essentially means it means the same thing. It's interchangeable.
Yeah. Well, I guess. Yeah, who cares? Anyway, they've declared themselves the Islamic State, and they really do have one.
If you call it Islamic, I mean, you know, even if you look at the whole tradition of caliphates, you know, that which is the, you know, what is supposed to be the representative of the faith on earth, going back to the time of the Prophet Muhammad running through the Ottoman Empire, you know, these guys, you know, the minorities, you know, Christians, Jews, others, were, you know, didn't have equal rights to Muslims, but they generally were not targeted and persecuted. They had a fair amount of autonomy. They even had their own judicial systems. You know, there was there's something, this group that calls itself Islamic, it's a cult. I mean, this is like M. Shinrikyo is to Shintoism, where Kony's Lord's Resistance Army in Uganda is to Christianity. I mean, these guys are really really beyond the pale. And they don't just consider religious minorities the infidels, but anybody who disagrees with them, even devout Sunni Muslims. So I think some people are just reluctant to even use the word Islamic State, just because it's an insult to Muslims that these guys would use the name. But yeah, whatever you call it.
Well, you know
really
what? Let me ask you this, because I just finished reading Patrick Coburn's book. And I mean, I follow everything Patrick Coburn writes anyway. I just finished reading his new book about this, and he was saying, and I think this must be true, that not just Wahhabism, but even the more so-called virulent, more nihilist strain of Salafism, Bin Ladenite ways of thinking, is really on the march throughout Sunni Islam, certainly in the Arab world. It's growing in greater proportions all the time. And he didn't really try to put a percentage on it or anything like that. And obviously you could hang almost all the responsibility for that around the neck of Bush and Obama for, you know, causing this kind of violent ideological reaction to their behavior in the region. And Patrick, of course, also highlights the Saudi money behind spreading Wahhabi-type educational systems around the entire Muslim world, not just in the Arab world, but obviously into Pakistan and everywhere else. But so I wonder if you have any kind of ballpark estimate as to percentages and rate of growth of this more fundamentalist kind of Bin Ladenite way of looking at things.
I don't really. It's very, very tiny. Single digit certainly. But you know, the thing is that these guys are fanatics, and they end up out hustling, out organizing others, especially when there's a, you know, rough alternatives and there are grievances that a lot of people can identify with. You know, it's like communist movements. You know, very few peasants in these various countries consider themselves communist, but, you know, they were, but the communist movements were able to have a disproportionate amount of influence because, the oppression, corruption, everything was so bad. People were so desperate and people were able to latch on to some ideology, that tended to motivate them. And of course, you know, just as, the U.S. Policy of intervention and propping up these right-wing dictatorships actually created more communists than we killed. Similarly, we are creating more of these extremists by, you know, the very policies that our government has been pursuing. And I mean, the thing is this, especially the sectarian business, you know, the difference between Sunnis and Shias theologically is less than that between Catholics and Protestants. I mean, for the vast majority of the history of Islam, it's not been a big deal. But there have been a number of things, a lot of which has been a direct consequence of U.S. policy. It has made it a big deal in some places. For example, when the U.S. took over Iraq, we ended up systematically dismantling the two bastions of secular nationalism, the armed forces, which were replaced by these sectarian Shiite militia, most of which had been actually trained by the Iranian Revolutionary Guard, actually fought with Iran during the Iran-Iraq War, which led to a lot of resentment among a lot of Iraqis, particularly you know, Sunnis, that the United States essentially put in you know, their historic enemies, the Western imperialists, U.S. and Britain, and the Persians, had essentially taken over their government. Some extremist Sunnis started killing random Shias, just like some Irish Catholic nationalists started killing random Protestants because they assumed that they were supporting what, you know, they saw as an occupation. And then the hardline Shiite government started murdering Sunni, random Sunni men by the thousands. And then lo and behold, you do end up with this sectarian conflict. But it was a direct consequence of destroying the armed forces and having it replaced by these repressive Shiite militias. It was the fact that the United States essentially dismantled the entire civil service, which was the other bastion of secular nationalism, and it was replaced. The government ministries became these personal fiefdoms of these, again, Shiite sectarian parties. And it was divide and rule. This is not an accident. I mean, I don't think the United States expected things to get as far out of hand as it did and get as crazy as it did. But there was definitely a conscious policy of trying to, we saw the nationalism, was a much bigger threat to U.S. hegemony, and was hoping that, you know, dividing people along sectarian or regional lines might enable the U.S. to have more influence.
Yeah. No, I think that's such an important point, and people ought to be reminded of that all the time. I've seen people saying, oh, yeah, it's all Bush's fault or whatever. But no, I mean, it's important. The history is important, not for blaming Bush for fun, but so that people understand the situation. It wasn't even just that they invaded and killed Saddam, overthrew Saddam. It's that they stayed and they picked the most Iranian-backed, the most sectarian of the Shiite leaders, and stayed for years and years and helped them kill a million people and kick all the Sunnis out of Baghdad and remove the last incentive that they had to ever compromise or work with the Sunnis again, all the while marginalizing Shiite leaders like Muqtada Sadr, who actually wanted to form, you know, what he called the Government of National Salvation, an Iraqi nationalist Arab government, and with the Kurds too, but based on Iraqi nationalism and seeking to marginalize Iran and America. And so America chased Sadr into Iran and called him the Iranian puppet while they worked on putting Dawah and Skiri in power. And yeah, no, that's such an important point about how this is all America's fault. It drives me crazy. And luckily we have another segment so that you can talk too. We'll be right back, everybody, with Professor Stephen Zunis on the other side of this break about Iraq War 3 now. It's the Scott Horton Show. Hey, all, Scott Horton here. Coming up this October 18th at Columbia University in New York, the Future Freedom Foundation is hosting a conference titled Stop the Wars on Drugs and Terrorism, featuring Glenn Greenwald, Radley Balco, Jeremy Scahill, Eugene Jarecki, Jonathan Turley, and others. The event is free and open to the public, but registration is required. Just head over to fff.org to sign up. That's the Stop the Wars on Drugs and Terrorism Conference, Saturday, October 18th, 2014 at Columbia University, sponsored by the Future Freedom Foundation at fff.org. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. I'm online with Stephen Zunis. And so we're talking a little bit of Iraq history here and how they turned a faction fight into now it's gone so far it really has become about religion, where these, it's, you know, ISIS is basically Zarqawi's group, Al-Qaeda in Iraq, and I don't know if you saw this thing, Stephen, by Lawrence Wright in The New Yorker about a month ago or so. called the Islamic State's Strategy of Savagery, and how, you know, war is the health of a militia. That's basically what these guys are.
Very much. There's no question that these horrific videos of people being beheaded and that kind of thing was to provoke a reaction, to get the West to intervene, so then they could portray themselves as the defenders of the faith against the infidel imperialist. We're falling right into their trap here. I mean, this is like 9/11, you know.
Even to the degree of allying with Iran again against them.
Yeah, yeah, and in effect with Assad, and with, you know, and then, you know, with Saudi Arabia, which has beheaded a lot more people than ISIS ever has, and these other autocratic regimes. I mean, yeah, this is pretty crazy. I mean, they want this. Just as Bin Laden hoped that 9/11 would get the United States to do something stupid like invade Iraq, which we obliged. You know, they're hoping to, you know, that this will get people to rally around and support them. Because here's the key thing. The only real hope of defeating ISIS is the same way that Zarqawi's group was defeated in Iraq six years ago. And that was when the Sunnis in the areas they controlled said, guys are so crazy, they're even worse than the Iraqi regime and the Americans, so we will organize and we'll fight them. And that's how they got defeated. But the problem is that if the U.S. is bombing the cities, as they're doing, they're already killing civilians. You know, people, instead of rebelling against ISIS, as they already have begun to do in a few areas, they're going to rally around to fight the foreign invaders. So even putting aside, you know, the important you know, moral and legal arguments, strategically, in terms of defeating these guys, we're going about it all wrong.
Yeah. Well, and, you know, I talked with Michael Scheuer about this on the show last week, I guess it was, yeah. And that was what he was saying. You know, these beheadings are just bait on the hook. They're trying to get us to intervene here. And then, like you're saying, it can't be more perfect for the Islamic State to, in effect, ally with Assad, which, of course, I think you've agreed with me about this. I've certainly been against supporting the rebels against him this entire time, too, in any way. But now supporting him against them, supporting the Iranian-backed militias and Iranian-backed Iraqi government against them, and even bringing in all the corrupt kingdoms and the emirs and sheiks and self-appointed dictators of Arabia is just too perfect. It makes the whole thing seem like a pro-Shiite thing. It also puts all the GCC countries in the very worst light as being the sock puppets of the Americans, when their populations are sure to much more lean toward ISIS's goals than their kings when they come to America's beck and call in this. And so it's not just that it's what they want. It's exactly what they want to the nth degree, better than they could have hoped for.
Exactly. I mean, you know, it's so bizarre when you think about it. I mean, at this time last year, start of the semester, I was having to explain to my students why the United States might be on the verge of going to war against the Syrian regime. Now I'm having to explain why we're going to war against Syrian rebels. And we've been bombing this part of the world on and off for nearly a quarter century now. And things have just gotten worse. And, you know, they're really, I mean, there should be a lesson in that, you know, this is not working. We're playing right into their trap. They're the ones that if they can, you know, grasp onto the, nationalist card, it's just going to make them stronger.
Yeah. All right. Now, so let me ask you this. I was laid off 2 years ago, but basically I'm still the editor. Now I'm the editor of antiwar.com. And so I got a policy, that says that if your article says, their plan is still regime change against Assad, or if your article says, yeah, now they're aligning with Assad against these guys or whatever, that either one of those positions is fine with me. Neither of those is a deal breaker because I don't know what the hell they're doing. I don't know. It seems like the debate, maybe they haven't even decided yet, Stephen. But on one hand, not that I support this. Again, I think it'll horribly backfire and blow up in our face. It's the wrong thing to do. But at least on the face of it, it makes sense to back Assad against his enemies and our enemies in the Islamic State, this new country run by sworn bin Ladenite types. But then on the other hand, hey, Israel and Saudi and Qatar, they really hate Assad and they want to see him go. And if you look at Israel's representatives in the U.S. Senate, like John McCain, for example, first and foremost, they are absolutely not over it at all. They want to see, they are really serious about seeing the FSA defeat Assad. It seems like it's still a higher priority even than fighting ISIS. And I wonder what you think they're going to do there or what they're doing already.
I think they're pretty confused right now. I mean, the problem is that, it's not simply a three-sided civil war because the FSA itself, it consists of hundreds of separate militia that are not under any kind of central command, that range the gamut politically. You know, some are people who really do want a more democratic and inclusive, Syria. I think, people that, I think a lot of us could actually identify with, but they also, you also have groups, that are hardcore Islamist as well. You have people who are, very parochial views about one thing or another. The thing is, it's a mess. It's like giving arms to a disorganized, cluster of independent operating militias does not mean they're going to be able to defeat ISIS or the regime. It just means more people are going to get killed, especially when you think about the fact that ISIS has gotten a lot of its arms from overrunning these FSA positions and from FSA factions that ended up getting radicalized in the course of the struggle and ended up joining ISIS. And guess what? They've taken their guns and military equipment, including U.S. manufactured equipment, with them. And in fact, most of ISIS's weapons are U.S. made, from positions they've captured in Syria, but even more so from Iraq. Mm-hmm. So, the idea that sending more arms and training more rebels is somehow going to help the situation is ridiculous. It's just going to strengthen the bad guys.
Yeah, well, see, this is the thing about it. Like I was saying, at least the Assad thing makes sense on the face of it. But the official policy, as Obama put it, supporting this third force of rebels as a counterweight to both Assad and ISIS, and he left out Nusra and the Islamic Front and Ahrar al-Sham and blah, 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 and keep going on. So their plan is to take these guys to Saudi Arabia for a year and train them when, as everybody knows, that there's really no distinction between who's fighting with the al-Nusra Front and who's fighting with the FSA. And, how long? You could count probably on one hand the number of minutes between the first time they give these guys live ammo to train with and the first green-on-blue attack there at the training camp in Saudi Arabia. I mean, it's absolutely insane what they're talking about doing here, with continuing with the policy of backing the FSA that was defeated 8 months ago.
Yeah, it doesn't make much sense at all. I think people are really, really scrambling. I think it's these guys who are in charge, frankly, I mean, they feel okay that there's this potential threat here and we got to respond militarily. And they, without thinking about the implications of what they're doing and how it's going to feed the very instability that came here in the first place. I mean, this is meme going around that just talked about how the United States that we want our enemies to lose, but we're supporting other enemies to defeat them, and it was this nice little I wish I could find it right now, but it was quite humorous about just this is their circuitous logic that got us into this mess,
right?
And it's just going to get worse if we try to keep pushing for a military solution, and it's really frightening actually how many. I mean, again, if, and this is just a hypothetical, you know, if there are ISIS armored columns out in the desert heading towards a village of some minorities and they're planning to, you know, wipe out and massacre thousands of people, you know, as anti-interventionist as I am, I wouldn't object if we sent in a few cruise missiles and took out those columns. But this idea that we're actually bombing these cities now and that we are escalating this into a full-scale war of indeterminate length, I mean, that's really beyond the pale. For one thing,
yeah, but I mean, come on, man. Saddam Hussein killed 100,000 Kurds. If you're, you know, you give these guys one inch, you give them 1,000 miles. You know, I know, but still, yeah. That was part of the whole shtick in 2003. Like, you could hardly argue that al-Baghdadi is more violent than Saddam Hussein was. The truth of the matter is, this is the thing that we are.
Yeah, the president is getting us into a war without going to Congress.
And the point is, we shouldn't have any cruise missiles to shoot, and our boats shouldn't be near enough to shoot any, and there shouldn't be a world empire enforced by America.
Failure. You could argue that the bombing in Iraq is legal because the Iraqi government asked us to, but in Syria, clearly without that government permission.
Yeah, but the Islamic State declared independence from Iraq. A body doesn't have jurisdiction to give permission to bomb Mosul.
But yeah, it raises, you know, questions with international law as well. I mean, all around, the more I look at, I didn't like the idea of this from the beginning, but yeah, you know, I left a little wiggle room saying, well, you know, maybe in certain circumstances, this or that or the other, but it's clear, as you say, you know, given an inch will take a yard, it's really already going way beyond what could be
possible. And even the Yazidi thing was fake, right? I mean, the special forces told Barbara Starr at CNN, yeah, we got there, and there were about 10,000 Yazidis there. The rest who wanted to flee had already fled with the PKK commie Kurds, had helped them escape. And it was never 400,000, and they wanted to stay, and they weren't under threat. Huh?
Here's the crazy thing. The PKK, the United States, you know, provided the Turks with arms, advisors, and more, that was responsible for the deaths of 30,000 Kurds, the destruction of hundreds of villages in the 1990s.
Right.
You know, with the exception of Israel, more civilians died, you know, from the, using U.S. ordnance, you know, than any other country that the U.S. supplied. A really terrible, horrific campaign, which in many ways was as bad or worse than what the Serbs are doing to the Kosovar Albanians, which we then use as an excuse because this can't take place on NATO's doorstep in the way words of Clinton, when in fact worse things were happening within NATO that we were facilitating. Yeah. But anyway, what I'm saying is that despite all the effort and all the suffering we inflicted to fight the evil PKK, now we're allying with those guys to fight ISIS as well.
Yeah, and when the Yazidis, the ones who were under threat and wanted to get the hell out of there, the PKK provided them refuge, but that served as the Gulf of Tonkin excuse for this one. That was the babies in the incubators for this one, Stephen, was, oh no, the Yazidis on the mountain. The few of us who had ever even heard of them before thought, oh no, I hope ISIS doesn't kill them all, but boy, as an excuse to, as you said, look at where we are now. We already got 2,000 troops. That doesn't count the special forces that are there. They don't tell us the number of JSOC and SOCOM and CIA running around, flying drones and whatever else, lasing targets. And it's already on in the name of the Yazidis, you know. And everybody already forgot about the Yazidis by now, but good enough, you know.
Right. This is, I think we're going to see a pattern we've seen before, that we're going to have, initially has a majority support because the scare tactics have worked. But gradually, as it seems to not be working, as it seems to be longer and more expensive and more involved than people, intended, there's going to be more and more skepticism. And I'm sure that's not, it probably doesn't feel that good, but still, once again, you can remind your listeners that you saw this coming and you warned people.
I know, yeah. Well, that's not much of a silver lining. I could do a whole show of nothing but I told you so's for what good I do. All right, anyway, we're way over time. I better let you go, but thanks very much for your time. It's great to talk to you again, Stephen.
Sure thing, likewise.
All right, y'all, that's Stephen Zunis. He is a professor of politics and program director for Middle Eastern Studies at the University of San Francisco. His latest is called The U.S. Should Use Caution in the Fight Against ISIL. We'll be right back. You hate government? One of them libertarian types? Or maybe you just can't stand the president, gun grabbers, or warmongers. Me too. That's why I invented LibertyStickers.com. Well, Rick owns it now, and I didn't make up all of them, but still, if you're driving around and want to tell everyone else how wrong their politics are, there's only one place to go. LibertyStickers.com has got your bumper covered. Left, right, libertarian, empire, police state, founders quote, central banking. Yes, bumper stickers about central banking. Lots of them. And, well, everything that matters. LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm going to take these off. Hey, it's my show, The Scott Horton Show. Coming up on the show, I don't know. More complaining by me. Let's see. Oh, here, nope, Nick can't do it. Later in the fall. Boy, is Nick Terse ever hard to get on the radio show. And that's a problematic problem. Because Nick Terse is the best guy on the invasion of Africa that there is, that I know of. I mean, if you just type in Terse, T-U-R-S-E, and Africa, you'll find, I don't know. Jeez, you know, I don't think he's written a book about it yet. I don't know why he hadn't written a whole book yet. But he's written, I don't know, dozens of articles about especially the special forces going in and training up armies all across and navies all across the African continent, waging proxy wars, setting up dictatorships. A mission a day on average there under the auspices of AFRICOM. You knew they were serious when they created AFRICOM. You know, they used to, you know how the Pentagon divides the entire planet up into its separate military commands. It used to be that Africa was an afterthought and was divided under two or three separate commands. Once they decided, hey, let's create an African command, boy, you knew that that was trouble. Jesus. In fact, sorry, I know that's very offensive to people sometimes, but I forget how bad it is. I'm sorry. Gee whiz, how about that? So here's my post-it note with my two favorite AFRICOM quotes. And you know, there are better quotes here about keeping China out and stuff like that. But these are just my kind of public choice theory of invading Africa quotes here. The first one is from the New York Times. It's General David M. Rodriguez, the head of the African Command. I guess he's the guy that replaced General Hamm. And he says, with the United States military out of Iraq, oops, and pulling out of Afghanistan, the Army is looking for new missions around the world. As we reduce the rotational requirement to combat areas, we can use these forces to great effect in Africa, he told Congress. And then the other one is from DefenseNews.com, and pardon the redundancy, it's poor writing, but it is what it is. Based at Fort Riley, Kansas, the Dagger Brigade, you know, for, like, stabbing people in the back with. The Dagger Brigade will be the first regionally aligned brigade the Army will field. Huh? As part of a new initiative to keep non-deploying units engaged globally. Now that rotations to Iraq have ended, deployments to Afghanistan are winding down, and the service is looking for ways to stay globally engaged. They are engaged globally, globally engaged, you see. And so but it's hard to understand the way Pentagon people write. And again, that's DefenseNews.com, so they're just basically regurgitating it all in Pentagon newspeak. The first regionally aligned brigade the Army will field as part of a new initiative to keep non-deploying units. What they mean is these troops ain't got nothing to do, so they're gonna go kill Africans so that they have something to do other than having to go and get a real job. Simple as that. You pull all the troops out of Iraq, well, what are we gonna do with them? Let's kill Africans then. And so away they go. It's the politics of bureaucracy. It's the economics of bureaucracy. What are they going to do? Go away? Nope. They'll just have to find something. And now Nick Turse has a brand new one out at Tom Dispatch today called American Success and the Rise of West African Piracy. And I'm afraid I actually only got about halfway through this article before I had to quit and start reading something else this morning. But it's about piracy in the Gulf of Guinea there in West Africa. And how that, you know, AFRICOM claims this is the reason for their existence, is so that they can keep all the sea lanes clear. If you watch CNN, you see the advertisement for the Navy all day. Oh boy, if it wasn't for the Navy keeping the sea lanes clear, no one would ever trade anything with anyone, they claim. That's why we need them. And yet, he goes on to explain here how they've certainly not succeeded in that whatsoever. I hope that lower down in the article he gets to the fact that all the hype about piracy off the coast of Somalia was all as a direct result to the chaos caused there by America's invasion in 2006. You know, under the auspices of hiring the Ethiopian dictator Meles Zenawi to do it for us, but still, it was George Bush's call. And it's actually in the WikiLeaks that they admit that they really twisted Zenawi's arm, Meles. I don't know, for some reason you're supposed to refer to him by his first name, not his last. I guess that's an Ethiopian thing. Anyway, they really twisted his arm and had him do it, made him do it. It was Rob Prince who wrote that up at Foreign Policy and Focus, if you want to read about that. Bush, Somalia, 2006, Rob Prince, WikiLeaks, those are your keywords. And I interviewed him about that, by the way, if you want to go back and check the details on scotthorton.org, you can find Rob Prince on there. But anyway, so it was the chaos and devastation in Somalia caused by the American intervention there this whole time, really since 2001, but especially since 2006, that really led to the rise of the pirates and all of that in the first place. But whatever, as long as there's a crisis, history always just began yesterday, so it doesn't matter that American intervention is the cause of any of these things in any of these cases. Let us claim a new excuse to move right ahead. Yeah. And anyway, you know, I'm sorry, let me find in here because I did mean to find it. I know he mentions in the beginning of this article here somewhere. Yeah, let me rewind. God dang it, Bobby. I'm sorry, I should not be paging through an article, you know, dead air-wise, live like this. I'm looking for the number of African nations that have American soldiers stationed in them right now. I think it's 52 African nation states altogether, and then it's how many out of 50? All right. Find on this page. 52. I could have swore I read that number. Nope, I didn't read 52. All right. Didn't I read 52 in here? Well, anyway, America's taking over Africa. Nick Turse is writing about it at TomDispatch.com. And in fact, after you read that one, yeah, it's not as interesting as some of the others. But just search at TomDispatch.com or search at antiwar.com for Turse in Africa and learn all about the Special Forces missions there. It's mostly training death squads, a.k.a. armies, state armies over there. Sometimes, you know, missions like supposedly, question mark, hunting Joseph Kony or whatever excuse that was to expand further in Uganda. Oh, and wherever you hear expand, also keep in mind that means trying to keep China out has a lot to do with this. You know, it's a lot of make work for the army, too. And it'll stay out of the headlines. There'll be plenty of work for them, and yet the American people, it'll never be brought to the American people's attention in any major way, really, unless they need a major excuse for a major new intervention. It seems to me, I've been predicting for way too long now, I guess, that there'll be an invasion of Nigeria. I first thought so back in 2007, although they hired the Nigerian army to go ahead and solve the problem there, the rebels in the Niger Delta that were kidnapping Shell executives, teaching them how unfair their practices were, and then releasing them. That had to be put an end to right there, you know. Can't have that. All right, back in a second.
Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson knows his stuff. He made a killing running his own hedge fund and always gets out of the stock market before the government-generated bubbles pop, which is, by the way, what he's doing right now, selling all his stocks and betting on gold and commodities. Sign up at WallStreetWindow.com and get real-time updates from Mike on all his market moves. It's hard to know how to protect your savings and earn a good return in an economy like this. Mike Swanson can help. Follow along on paper and see for yourself. WallStreetWindow.com.
All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton, and this is my show, The Scott Horton Show. I'm going to get down to business here with you. This is the 27th of February, 2009, is this clip. It's Jim Mikleshevsky, NBC News Pentagon reporter. And he's reporting right before Obama goes on to give his "We're Getting Out of Iraq" speech. If you want to know what I thought of that speech, you can go and read Finding Ways to Stay in Iraq by Scott Horton. But this is what Jim Mikleshevsky and the Pentagon thought of the speech before Obama gave it. And, you know, let me fast forward a little bit here because this clip is about 2.5-3 minutes long. I don't want you to phase out on me. Jim Mikleshevsky, you'll recognize his voice, NBC News Pentagon reporter, talking about, well, what's the word at the Pentagon over there, Mick? That's his nickname, not Jim. What's the word at the Pentagon over there, Mick, with Obama coming on talking about we're getting out of Iraq?
Two quick points about Secretary Gates. Even during the campaign, if you listen to what Secretary Gates was saying about the U.S. military operations in Iraq and what Barack Obama were saying, they were not that far apart. Secretary Gates, as early as 18 months to 2 years ago, was saying, look, everybody understands that we're going to have to start withdrawing from Iraq. But at the same time, Secretary Gates adds this caveat that, in fact, he believes significant numbers of troops will remain in Iraq for years to come. And in fact, military commanders, despite this standard of forces agreement with the Iraqi government that all U.S. forces would be out by the end of 2011, are already making plans for a significant number of American troops to remain in Iraq beyond that 2011 deadline, assuming that that SOFA agreement would be renegotiated. And one senior military commander told us that he expects large numbers of American troops to be in Iraq for the next 15 to 20 years, David.
15 to 20 years. I think that really takes a moment to really sink in with a mission that is primarily what over that kind of time horizon, Mick?
Well, it would evolve from, again, from a day-to-day combat mission to more of an oversight mission. And we mustn't forget that the U.S. is providing nearly 100% of all combat air support over Iraq, and that the Iraqi military is not going to be able to assume that mission within the next 18 months to 2 years. It's going to be impossible. And there are some discussions. I know Richard Engel mentioned the area of Kirkuk up in the north recently. There are some discussions among Iraqis, and I know some military commanders, to establish what could end up as a permanent air base, U.S. air base, in Kirkuk.
Right, all right. So there you go. That was 2009. That's Jim Mikleshevsky. Obama's about to announce that he's sticking with Bush's deal with Maliki to get the troops out by the end of 2011. Before he goes on, Mikleshevsky says, over here at the Pentagon, they're saying, yeah, right, we're going to negotiate the Status of Forces Agreement, and we're going to stay for 15 to 20 years at least as, you know, like the British imperialists, embedding Western officers with the local army to do our bidding, etc. And so, but that didn't work out. And what happened was, just like Maliki basically played George Bush in 2008, and we covered it in real time here on the show, especially with the help of Patrick Coburn, of course, that Bush was saying, give me 56 bases. And Maliki said, oh yeah, 56 bases? Sure, that sounds fine. I'll tell you what, wait right here. I'm going to go talk to the guys, and I'll be right back. Oh, you know, I talked to the guys, and you know what they said was, geez, that's just too many. How about a lower number? And Bush said, how about 50 bases? How about 40? How about 30? How about 20? How about, can we please have some bases? And then by then it was November of 2008, and Bush had to go. Or maybe it was September, it was right before the election. But anyway, he was lame duck. He had to sign a status of forces agreement because the United Nations mandate for the occupation was expiring on December 31st, 2008. He had to have a status of forces agreement. Obama wouldn't even be inaugurated until January 20th. So Maliki said, okay, here's the sofa, sign it. It says, get the hell out by the end of 2011. Thanks very much. It's been a pleasure working with you. Thanks for helping us kill all the Sunnis and take the capital city from them. Appreciate that a lot. And so Bush signed. And then anyway, I like telling that story just because everybody likes to say, oh, it's Obama's fault that he got out or whatever. It was Bush's fault. He fought a war for a bunch of people who hated his guts and had no need for him after he was done helping them win. And so they told him to get bent. And anyway, so then Obama came in. And the generals from the beginning were saying, yeah, we're not going with that. We want to stay. It's the Pentagon's war. As Gareth Porter says, he goes, you know, you can basically just forget about the rest. The generals rule America. They are the most powerful force. It's all about public choice theory, whatever you call it. It's all about domestic politics. It's all about individual ambition. And people inside the system getting what they want. And you line all them up, the generals and the admirals are way out in front of everybody else, and it's as simple as that. They have the power. You know why? Because they literally have the power. And so, you know, that's where we're at. I mean, go back in time and prevent President for Life Roosevelt from making it this way. Or, you know, shrug and get used to it. It's that old Seattle Times article from back in 2001 was titled Cheney's Grim Vision, Decades of War. We're going to take this group of a couple of hundred guys and we're going to make it a couple hundred thousand. How about that? Let's see if we can turn this into a real excuse for killing people. Get it going over the long term. The long war, that's what the generals tried to name it there for a while. And that goes for all of Central Asia as well as Arab lands. Just as long as they can keep fighting. And so here's the thing, and maybe this really needs to be, you know, out front at the beginning of each and every segment as I attempt to talk you out of supporting this war in every way I can think of to do, that there's going to be ground troops. You talk about giving them an inch, they'll take a yard, they'll take 1,000 miles. There's going to be ground troops, and here's why. Sheldon Richman is asking this question today at the Future Freedom Foundation. Is anybody noticing how incongruent it is for Obama to say, these guys are an imminent threat to America, we're going to destroy them, but we're not going to use ground troops to do it, we're going to have somebody else do it. And I don't think he really goes down the list, but I'll go down the list for you. The Iranian army, the Iranian-backed militias, the Iraqi army, the Turks, the Kurds, Assad's state government, none of them have the power to dislodge the Islamic State, even with American air power. Which of those forces, or all of them combined, are supposed to march on Mosul? Give me a break. That's not going to happen. If anyone is going to march on any of these cities and kick the Islamic State out, whether it's, I guess maybe Assad could take Raqqa with American air power support, direct air power support. But the Iraqi army take Mosul, Fallujah, or Tikrit? No. No. So, that's it. You let them have this war, they're going to send your son. Your neighbor's son. Hey, all Scott here. If you're like me, you need coffee. Lots of it. And you probably prefer it tastes good, too. Well, let me tell you about Darren's Coffee Company at darrenscoffee.com. Darren Marion is a natural entrepreneur who decided to leave his corporate job and strike out on his own, making great coffee. And Darren's Coffee is now delivering right to your door. Darren gets his beans direct from farmers around the world. All specialty, premium grade, with no filler. Hey, the man just wants everyone to have a chance to taste this great coffee. Darren's Coffee. Order now at darrenscoffee.com. Use promo code Scott and save $2. Darrenscoffee.com. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. Like I say, I'm taking tomorrow off. Gotta travel. But, be back Monday. So let's do Open Line Thursday. Obviously, the war against the Islamic State is the biggest news of all, but Eric Holder's resigning, and, there's pirates off the coast of Africa, and God knows what else. You guys can call in, talk about whatever you want if you want. Terror wars and related subjects. We could talk about Ukraine. Anybody has anything interesting to update us on what's going on there in eastern Ukraine? I know that's supposed to be my job, but anyway. The number is 512-271-4836. Be happy to hear from you. 512-271-4836. And actually, I guess I'll move this window where I can see it a little better. So I can see it a little better. And yeah, that'd be cool, man. So go ahead and call in if you guys want to do some calls. I don't do that too much, but I should. A lot of times you guys got a lot of things to say. Sometimes funny things. I like funny things. Here's something funny. Did you know this? That Baghdadi was a Sufi? I meant to ask Stephen Zunis about this. The Sufis, they're like the Unitarians of the Muslims, man. Those guys could get along at a meeting at AEI or something. Oh, yeah, we're the Sufis. They're nice guys. And there's an article that Zunis linked to. Man, I meant to ask him about this. It's a New York Times article. Baghdadi, the New York Times. Eric Schmidt piece. U.S. actions in Iraq fueled rise of a rebel. About how, yeah, he was a nice guy. Then they rounded him up and tortured him. And now he's Zarqawi, only with real power. Great. You know, Zarqawi was nothing but a two-bit rapist, scumbag, nobody. Until the Jordanian government tortured him. And turned him into a freedom fighter. On that side. That got scare quotes, if you couldn't hear them. The same thing with Ayman al-Zawahiri. Ayman al-Zawahiri knew a guy in the Muslim Brotherhood who may have known something about the assassination of Anwar Sadat. Or something like that. Father's brother's nephew's cousin's former roommate kind of a situation. And so, what did Hosni Mubarak do? He tortured Ayman al-Zawahiri. And turned him into Ayman al-Zawahiri. There's something about being tortured that people don't like. It's just like the lesson every American cop is told on the first day of training. I know you're looking for a chance to shoot somebody at your first opportunity. Just make sure you kill them. Otherwise, they could sue you, you know, or something. Otherwise, they could get on TV complaining about you to no effect whatsoever. How about that? And you don't want that. Same kind of thing. Lesson for the CIA. If you're going to torture these guys, kill them. Otherwise, they end up becoming gigantic leaders of terrorist movements against us. Crazy thing. Oh, and by the way, I did not mean to suggest that if the American government sent the Army and Marine Corps into those Iraqi cities to dislodge ISIS, that would do any good, really, other than, you know, in the immediate term. It certainly wouldn't destroy them. We've already seen the Americans fight in the Sunni Triangle for years on end. It only made these guys. So, you know, make sure to not get that wrong. Hey, let's take some calls. We got one. You guys call in too. It's 512-271-4836. 512-271-4836. Hey, I'm Scott. You're on.
Hey, Scott. It's Corky. How you doing, man?
I'm doing real good. How are you?
Doing all right. I wanted to ask you a question. You know, Charlie Rangel's been going on the air talking about reinstituting the draft and a war tax. Of course, he's not interested in donating any of his pension or his salary to that, but evidently he wants to send our kids and have us pay for it. What do you think the chances are of this escalating and this becoming a draft situation? Because I see that as a complete disaster. I mean, that'll bring people out in the streets, in my opinion.
Yeah. Well, I'll tell you what, I think the war tax is probably a 99.999% chance there. Did somebody say new tax? All of Washington, D.C. just perked up when you said that out loud. I mean, they heard Rangel, too. But anyway, yeah, no, I mean, if somebody's proposing a new tax in the name of fighting bad guys, then that is a slam dunk. As far as conscription goes, you know, things could conceivably get that bad where the argument becomes that we have to send a million-man army over there to defeat Islamic extremism once and for all or some kind of madness. That is a hell of a slippery slope, and we're certainly not there yet. But I think that one thing that we have really going for us on the conscription point is that the Army and the Marines do not want a bunch of conscripts. They want a bunch of guys who are willing to sign up for the pay, and they have unlimited budgets, basically. Even lowest-ranking privates and specialists have pretty good incomes and pensions and whatever. They can recruit as many guys as they think that they need. It's much, much easier for them than bossing around a bunch of guys who don't want to be there. But on the other hand, you know, if Barack Obama really wants to be great and go down in history, Corky, then you know, raising up a gigantic army and running for a third term and really going for that full FDR brass ring there or whatever. I mean, those things have happened in our past before. I would not say we should worry about it, but I would not entirely rule it out. I mean, you look at the fact that they insist on taking all sides in this sectarian war now, this what's now become pretty much a religious war. A civil war in the Arab world started by George W. Bush. And they insist on fighting for and against the Shia, for and against the Sunnis all the way around. And so, how it's going to play out, I really don't know. It's guaranteed to be trouble. And on the other hand, too, you can see how Obama doesn't want to send, you know, anyone other than the most, you know, bare minimum of soldiers because of the politics of it. Because the American people hate this stuff almost as much as you and me now. They're so over it. And so it would take, you know, something real convincing to get them to be willing to send their boys back to the Sunni Triangle to fight this war all over again, you know? I don't know.
Yeah, but they're gonna continue to try to scare everybody. I think I sent you an MSN article was talking about they're showing like the conversations between the rebels and the ISIS guys over there talking about, you know, how they're gonna attack American targets and stuff. And they'll just, and a lot of this stuff I'm sure is manufactured. I don't even believe half of what I read there. But you know, the whole fear factor really scares me in terms of the American people are so gullible. I mean, they're just so completely gullible. It's very it's really sad to watch, you know, as far as they still watch TV, they listen to these news shows and the idiots they put on TV, it's just so disheartening, you know.
Well, and it's a scientific fact too, that's the thing, man. They just did this study that they wrote about it at the National Interest, where the American people, if you ask them, they want less and less government involvement, you know, military involvement in the rest of the world. Leave everybody alone. Enough of this. We're tired of it. We don't want any more, whatever. But when you ask them specifically, hey, should we intervene here, there, or the other place for some human rights excuse or because somebody said that the oil might be threatened or basically anything, the answer is yes. They will support a war under any hypothetical excuse. They'll say, yeah. I mean, you would think it'd be easier to resist when they're just saying, hypothetically, would you kill all the Africans for a little bit of oil? They say, yeah. You know, so we're in a bad way as far as that goes. That's for sure.
Thanks for all you do. I hear the music playing, yeah. And thanks to you and Giraldi and Margolis and the rest of the guys, because you guys speak the truth, and that's a wonderful thing. So good luck, man. Have a good weekend.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
All right. Bye-bye.
Hey, I'm Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new book by Michael Swanson, The War State. In The War State, Swanson examines how Presidents Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy both expanded and fought to limit the rise of the new national security state after World War II. This nation is ever to live up to its creed of liberty and prosperity for everyone. We are going to have to abolish the empire. Know your enemy. Get The War State by Michael Swanson. It's available at your local bookstore or at Amazon.com in Kindle or in paperback. Just click the book in the right margin at ScottHorton.org or TheWarState.com. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. Yeah, I got to cover some news for you here. Oh, call in if you want. Talk about whatever you want. I guess I should set it up better than that. I should ask, like, the question of the day. How optimistic are you guys about all the wonderful glory that's going to come from this latest new war against the Iraqis? It's going to be awesome or the awesomest war ever? Question of the day for you. U.S. airstrikes in Syria don't slow ISIS offensive. U.S. airstrikes target ISIS-held oil refineries in Syria. Well, they were saying on TV this morning, yeah, it's only nothing percent of anything. It's nothing that they're trading or making money off of. It's their local gasoline supply near Raqqa, whatever. Marginal difference. Plenty of pollution, though. Syrian government minister, U.S. strikes going in the right direction. There you are fighting for Assad. And Syrian rebels slam U.S. strikes hitting al-Qaeda, not Assad. And here I will... that's Jason Ditz's write-up, but I'll refer you also to... That's at news.antiwar.com. There's also this one from yesterday by Prothero and Lande at McClatchyDC.com. U.S. strikes on Islamic State Khorasan in Syria. First step of a years-long campaign. That's one. And then the other one is by Roy Gutman with Musab al-Hamadi. And that Syrian rebels angry that strikes hit al-Qaeda ally, but not Assad. And that's about how the Americans are treading very lightly because they don't want to outright go to war with al-Qaeda in Syria. They're at war with ISIS in Syria. ISIS that split from al-Qaeda because they disagree that we got to fight the Americans first. They want to hurry up and have their caliphate now. But at the same time, you know, back away from and try not to rile up al-Nusra too much or hurt al-Nusra too bad, even though they're loyal to Ayman al-Zawahiri. And they're the ones who are harboring the so-called Khorasan unit, as Prothero and Lande put it. Khorasan unit of al-Nusra. That's all it is. Al-Nusra is just al-Qaeda in Syria. The veterans of al-Qaeda in Iraq, mostly, and, you know, at their leadership level anyway, and who are still loyal to Ayman al-Zawahiri. Our friends, the moderates, are all upset that they bombed some al-Nusra guys, too, the so-called Khorasan unit of guys who had a aspirational, more than actual, plot against the United States. Very bad PR for the American mission in Syria. We might radicalize our moderates if we bomb their friends, al-Qaeda. Huh? This is America's policy in Syria? I'm afraid so. Pentagon, ISIS war to last, quote, years. Obama vows worldwide struggle against the ISIS network of death. Oh, man. You know, I know, that was in the speech yesterday at the UN. I didn't really focus on it because I just thought it was stupid. But now I guess I realize it's kind of important, you know? Network of death. In other words, imagine a real power out there somewhere in the place of what we're actually dealing with. Worldwide struggle. Come on, they're completely landlocked and surrounded by enemies. worldwide struggle. And then, geez, guys, I don't know, man. I'm reading down the top headlines at antiwar.com, and I think I have to agree with Eric Garris's placement that this story, U.S. ties itself in legal knots with shifting rationale for Syria strikes, is merely an afterthought about halfway down the page. Oh, yeah, by the way, this entire thing is completely illegal. And even George Bush's lawyers are mocking the pretense that this is within the rule of law at all. The only thing that makes it legal is that John Boehner won't impeach him for it. John Boehner, he wouldn't even call the Congress back to session to debate it and vote on it. Never even mind a declaration of war. They won't even pass an authorization. All they do is pass an authorization for some money for the Syrian rebels. The most ridiculous part of this entire policy. They'll vote for money for that, but not to authorize it, because John Boehner, the Republican in the House, would defer to the president's authority on this. As, of course, would Harry Reid, the majority leader, Democratic majority leader of the Senate. So there you go. George Bush went to Congress, said, I'd like to kill all these people. Give me some authority. And they said, okay, Obama won't even go to Congress on this. It's amazing. And they won't force the issue. Well, that's because America's an empire. Did you know today's Bill of Rights Day? Does that count for anything? The U.S. Constitution at all? Today is Bill of Rights Day, according to a tweet I saw earlier, which I took as authoritative. Boy, that old law is just about gone now. The empire and its functionaries can do whatever they want, here or abroad. They have total immunity, total impunity. They're going to start a whole new years-long war and announce. You know, Bush said the Iraq war is going to take a few weeks. How long does it take to beat the crap out of the Iraqi army and occupy Baghdad? No time. And what threat are the Iraqi people in any combination to the new order once we get there? Psh, none at all. But he went to Congress for what he thought would be a 2-week long war. Obama says that authorization to go attack the Baathist government for their weapons of mass destruction counts and covers this. And, or, no, maybe it doesn't. Maybe it's the authorization to use military force against those who harbor those who attacked us on September 11th, except that ISIS is officially fired from Al-Qaeda, and to make it official, they announced, you can't fire us, we quit, and they suicide bombed Zawahiri's representative to come and that came to negotiate the situation. I guess he was trying to patch things up. Baghdad, he suicide bombed him to death. So much for that. And then they say, well, the War Powers Act, but the War Powers Act doesn't authorize aggressive war. The War Powers Act says if somebody attacks the United States, then the president can respond for 60 days, because that's the longest possible opportunity they could possibly give him to allow for Congress to get back in the event of a surprise attack by the Russians. Within 60 days, we gotta be able to get together a quorum to authorize this. You know, even if it was a war with the Russians. That was the theory. With the Soviets. The War Powers Act doesn't authorize this in any way. Anyway, and they don't care. Their ultimate answer is, yeah, we don't care. Their ultimate answer is, there's no such thing as the rule of law. There is no such thing as the rule of law that John Boehner will not enforce. And the truth is, he doesn't have to file for articles of impeachment in the House Judiciary Committee, although that would be nice. All he has to do is make a phone call to the president and say, hey, listen. Actually, he doesn't even have to do that. He just has to hold a vote. He has to pretend he's relevant in this at all. The Speaker of the House of Representatives of the opposition party right now in what's left of the United States of America, if you could call it that. It is. It's just an afterthought. Oh, yeah, by the way, under no plausible pretense is any of this legal, but what the hell's the law anyway? Other than what they can do to you. Checks and balances. Whatever. You know, Thomas Paine in The Rights of Man absolutely mocked the entire premise of having checks and balances. He goes, oh yeah, only Parliament can declare war, but only the king can wage it, huh? Yeah, right. All that means is you each have even more incentive to be warmongers, to rush to take the responsibility to make the other one do their part too, or whatever it is. Yeah, turns out he was right. Madison was wrong. Anyway, so it's on. Sign up now.
Hey, Al Scott here. If you've got a band, a business, a cause, or campaign, and you need stickers to help promote, check out thebumpersticker.com at thebumpersticker.com. They digitally print with solvent ink, so you get the photo quality results of digital with the strength and durability of old-style screen printing. I'm sure glad I sold thebumpersticker.com to Rick back when. He's made a hell of a great company out of it, and there are thousands of satisfied customers who agree with me, too. Let thebumpersticker.com help you get the word out. That's thebumpersticker.com at thebumpersticker.com.
All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. I'm taking callers and questions and statements at 512-271-4836. 512-271-4836. You can say things at me. You can ask things at me. You can just take the opportunity to address the rest of the audience and ignore me completely. I don't care. Do what you want. 512-271-4836. 512-271-4836. It's the Scott Horton Show. And, you know, like, say you need a footnote. Hey, Scott, what was that article that you're always recommending about how Elliot Abrams tried to do a coup d'etat in the Gaza Strip, but all the guns ended up falling into the hands of Hamas? And then I will answer, why, that's The Gaza Bombshell by David Rose in Vanity Fair. That's all you need to search, and you'll know all about it. For, you know, one example. Yeah. I'm actually not that smart, but I got a pretty good memory for where I read stuff. That's about all. So, I'm pretty useful that way. Can be. 512-271-4836. 512-271-4836 if anybody wants to call in the show. Otherwise, I guess I want to talk about the killer cops for a minute here and Eric Holder. Eric Holder's resigning as Attorney General. Ah, yay. And all that. So that's good. We'll be rid of him. He deserves to be in prison. For one thing, for signing off on the murder of Anwar al-Awlaki and his son. For two things. And I guess, geez, it's funny. Usually if you name an attorney general, I can rattle off all the reasons I think they should be in prison. Obviously, there's the Fast and Furious, this and that. Guess I'm not prepared for a complete and substantial denunciation of Eric Holder, but I guess he helped cover up the murder of Kenneth Trinidew will suffice. Oh, good. Another caller's called in. Any of you guys can call in to 512-271-4836. Hey, I'm Scott. You're on.
Hey, Scott. It's Fitz from San Francisco. How are you?
I'm doing real good. How are you?
Fine. And I was just wondering if you, how much credibility you get, you would give to this. I just saw on the Twitterverse earlier this morning, and you may have even mentioned it, but that apparently in the recent bombing campaign in Syria, that they were going after some of the actually oil facilities in Syria, mm-hmm. and you know the insinuation was that we're kind of doing the work of our Saudi paymasters to cut off their competition. I didn't know if you give any credibility to that assertion.
My understanding is that the targets that they hit were so insubstantial that that couldn't have been it. I mean, or I don't know what the hell it is, honestly, because at least the way they described it on TV this morning was that, you know, like they were conceding that this isn't even any of the oil that's being sold on the black market. I guess there were enough experts out there in the media saying so, and they kind of had to admit that this is basically just their local gasoline needs that have been eliminated here. Which is, you know, a tenth of a percent of, you know, what matters as far as their fuel, you know, resources.
Well, I guess that's so, straight out of the U.S. playbook of, you know, well, just like with the Serbians and things like that, you know, cut off their clean water and I guess cut off their gas. You know,
regular make the locals. Exactly. Make the locals, civilians suffer, but the army, they can get gas from elsewhere. It does not seem like it was a, you know, full-scale assault on every bit of oil resources in ISIS's hands is like a real attempt to somehow deprive them of energy in that way. And, of course, so much of this could just be solved by having our NATO ally, the Turks, close the border, Fitz. How are these gasoline trucks and their 18 wheels getting across the freaking border? Other than, you know, driving across it in a way that could be prevented. Come on. So, I don't know.
Yeah. Well, thanks for the show, Scott. I appreciate it.
All right. Thanks for calling in, man. Anybody else, you guys can call in too. 512-271-4836. 512-271-4836. And I guess, you know, come to think of it, the Americans with their airplanes could do, and their cruise missiles and drones, they could do quite a bit of damage to the Islamic State. But, you know, I really think we ought to be looking at this in terms of, you know, if the last Iraq war was too soon, then Vietnam, you know, never lost a battle, still lost the war. That kind of a thing. Take out some oil resources, cause them some pain here, kill a couple of their leaders there. But, you know, again, like we were talking about earlier in the show, even according to the New York Times, or maybe this is a symptom or an indication it's not true. It seems like a pretty big concession on the state's part to have an article like this in the Times, that this guy Baghdadi used to not be so bad until America made him that way the last war around. And now he's this ruthless homicidal maniac. Anyway, so I guess we don't know who comes next. Maybe somebody with less patience. Phone number 512-271-4836. I really should make this show more about calls and questions for the guests and that kind of thing. Why not? I should. If there's enough of you guys willing to call in anyway, then I could do it that way. 512-271-4836 if you want to call in. Eric Holder, he's out. I don't know who's going to replace him. Probably somebody worse. I guess I'll segue from there into these police killing stories that we have a real problem. Oh, good. Another caller's online. Hang on one second. I'm going to say this thing about the local killer cops for a second, especially on Bill of Rights Day. The Bill of Rights is supposed to be a list of restrictions against the national government. The fact that now in 2014 and over the last, you know, half a century or more, really, 70, 80 years, the Bill of Rights has turned into a mandate to the national government to protect individuals from the state governments. I'm not saying it hadn't seemed absolutely necessary in some cases. Obviously, you could think of a lot. But just how backwards is it now where the local grand jury each and every time, maybe it was always this way, but they'll let the cops get away absolutely with murder. And the best thing that anybody can think of to do is to ask the federal government, the U.S. Justice Department, whose number one job is covering for the worst criminals on the face of the planet, to come and protect us from our local cops. It just goes to show how top down our so-called democracy is in this imperial system, far from what we're taught in school to believe the American system is supposed to be, really. And so in the case of this guy who was shot in the Walmart everybody's saying, well, if the locals won't prosecute him, the feds got to do something, right? Makes sense, but it seems to me like there'd be a better way, but I don't know. Lynch mob? Bring back the lynch mob, but only for killer cops. I don't know. Maybe not. All right, so let me hit this button and then this button. Hey, I'm Scott. You're on the air.
Hi, Scott. I really enjoy the show. You get incredible guests on your show, and I find it fascinating. I do have what may seem like a gratuitous question, but I'm really curious about what your feelings are about the influence of the Saudis, the Israelis, and the American intelligence agencies, and the actual training of ISIS. In particular, you see the same film of tennis shoes that are basically Nike tennis shoes with Toyota trucks. Why don't they just bomb the Mosul Toyota dealership if they want to stop ISIS? I really think it's really a manufactured crisis that we have. And I recognize that you do think that they're a threat coming back to the United States, but obviously they track anybody that goes into that area from the United States.
Well, I'm not so sure. I think that's the first place I dispute. I have no faith in the FBI, et cetera, to keep these guys out of the country. They're too busy entrapping nobodies into nothing plots over here to do their real job. And then the music's playing. I got to go. In fact, if you want, hang on the line, and we'll be back in 4 minutes, and I'll get to the other part of your question.
Right on.
It's the Scott Horton Show, y'all. Stay tuned. Hey, y'all. Scott Horton here. It's always safe to say that one should keep at least some of your savings in precious metals as a hedge against inflation. And if this economy ever does heat back up and the banks start expanding credit, rising prices could make metals a very profitable bet. Since 1977, Robertson Roberts Brokerage, Inc. has been helping people buy and sell gold, silver, platinum, and palladium, and they do it well. They're fast, reliable, and trusted for more than 35 years. And they take Bitcoin. Call Robertson Roberts at 1-800-874-9760 or stop by rrbi.co. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. I'm on Liberty Radio Network, noon to 3 weekdays, except for tomorrow. And I'm at scotthorton.org. I got 3,500 interviews at scotthorton.org/interviews. I'm taking calls. I should do this more often. I'm taking calls. It's 512-271-4836. We gave up the 800 number because it costs too much, but whatever. You can afford it. 512-271-4836 to call in. And so we have a caller on the line. And then so the question was, so these guys might want to blow us up, but the feds can keep them out, right? And, you know, I give you mostly credit for that, that they certainly should be able to. I guess I would have more confidence in the other countries' intelligence services and national police forces for keeping these guys out of America on their side of the security line than the American idiots over here, the goofballs at the FBI.
The crisis,
I'm sorry?
The crisis completely manufactured.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's the other point. Yeah, that's the other point. Sorry.
Where's the Toyota dealership? Is it Mosul? I mean, they're brand new trucks.
No, it's Washington, D.C. The trucks came from D.C. There are two great articles. In fact, if you go to my Twitter timeline and go back a couple of days, I got an argument with a guy about this. And you can find there's, if you just put in FSA Toyotas, they should come right up, actually. Public Radio International and foreignpolicy.com, although they have the worst paywall in the world now. So you may have difficulty with the foreignpolicy.com story. But they're both from this spring. They're both from before the fall of Mosul and the rise of ISIS as a real news story and all of this, latest phase of this. And the story was they were delivered to the Free Syrian Army, and the Free Syrian Army wanted more. And I can't give you a better chain of custody than that, but I think it's a very, very reasonable assumption that the trucks, the Toyotas that you saw in those pictures of these guys flooding into Mosul and the rest of the cities that they've taken, that's where they were. And I don't know whether the Free Syrian Army gave them to ISIS or if ISIS defeated them in battle and seized them or what. I don't know how many trucks they've given them over what period of time. Remember, the entire weapons store on the Turkish border was sacked back in December, where the American ambassador was pathetically out there asking, can we please have our stuff back? when I think it was ISIS and al-Nusra together raided it and took it all. So, yes, they're American trucks. And believe me, I'd be the first to accuse them if I had a real good reason to believe. But I don't have any real reason to believe the Americans gave trucks directly to ISIS. On the other hand, though, they could have got them from some other source, and maybe I am making too much of a leap to conclusion that they got the trucks from the FSA. It could be that they got them from the Saudis.
There'd be at least a finite supply unless our beloved administration continues to supply them, right? There's got to be X amount of Toyota trucks. They're going to bomb them. They're gone. They don't have any more trucks to get around the desert. It's so, on the face of it, illogical that you have an X number of trucks. They're going to bomb them. Okay, trucks no longer there. They don't control anything except a bunch of sand in the middle of Iraq and Syria.
Well, don't forget all the Fords that they seized when they sacked all those parts of northwestern Iraq. There's footage of them saying, yeah, look at me. I'm in a Ford F-350, buddy, with an extended cab and dualies on the back axle.
One last question, Scott. Sure. I really appreciate your show.
Yeah.
At least they're buying American. That's all I can say about the Fords. Hopefully they're made in California or Michigan or whatever. But it is a red herring, admittedly. The three folks who were allegedly beheaded, this terrible terrorist group, however terrible they are, refuses to actually show the beheading. You could argue that they might be dead, but the beheading, which triggered this whole crisis, no actual chopping off of the heads with a paraknife at best. The guy, the left-handed guy, always has like a knife. I use a bigger one to peel an apple. How about the manufacturing of the beheadings? They do not actually show it on the screen. Why not?
Yeah, that's another good question. And I want to get back to the degree of how manufactured this all is and how much of America's fault it all is, too, because it's an important point. I didn't really answer that thoroughly yet. But as far as the beheadings, here's where I come down on that. The families and friends of the dead don't have any dispute over whether that's their families and friends' disembodied head sitting on their back in the final frame. Now, I know special effects are good nowadays and all that kind of thing, but you show somebody a picture that you claim is their son's head cut off, sitting, resting on his own back. For them to buy it, it seems to me, it's got to be pretty real. And, you know, like I talked with Mitchell Prothero, reporting out of Iraq right after, I think, the first one. Or no, it was the second one, Sotloff, I think, and how there was this discrepancy because the anti-Assad conspiracy kooks, the neocon kooks, were trying to say that Assad had Sotloff and sold him to ISIS rather than the moderates had him. Northern Storm had him and sold him to ISIS. And he debunked that and said that was, and I think he was referring to Stratfor, but he said it was a private intelligence agency that came up with that thing, and it was nonsense, and that all the guys in the region, all the reporters in the region, they knew where he got kidnapped and who was kidnapping people around there, and he was deep in jihadi territory, and how it really raised the question of the embargo on the news of captured journalists serves a purpose, that they want to be able to negotiate without it becoming a big media circus. At the same time, though, they end up actually keeping, accidentally, you know, in effect, they're keeping information from other journalists about just how many guys have been nabbed when they went down that road and don't go down that damn road, and how the journalists together were talking about how they've got to get it together and figure out, you know, whatever. So in other words, it seems to me like there are very credible sources who really knew these guys, who knew where they were last seen, that they were definitely abducted by al-Nusra / ISIS types, and then who do not dispute at all that that's their heads cut off, at least in the end clips of those videos, which raises, of course, the important question of, well, why the fakery of the actual taking of the knife to the throat? The most reasonable answer, I think, surprisingly, came from Russ Baker at Who What Why, who said that, well, probably these guys made a deal that if you read the propaganda we want you to read and say the statement we want you to say, we'll kill you with a bullet and cut your head off after. And that these guys made that compromise rather than actually die in the worst way possible. Just as the Occam's razor explanation, I'm not saying there's direct evidence that that was the deal that was made, but just that that's the most plausible explanation when you take into account the fact that, oh, they're missing all right, and they were in the hands of these bastards all right, and no one who knows them is disputing that they're certainly dead and their heads are cut off at the end clips of the video. So that's my thinking on it. If you have a, you know, an objection to any of that, I'm happy to hear it, but that's the best I know.
Well, they're remarkably calm, all three of them. It's almost like it's definitely they're reading the teleprompter, they're reading scripts, but they're remarkably calm. I agree it's probably irrelevant that they're dead. I'm sure that they're not alive. Do you know them as being actually legitimate journalists before they were killed, before they were beheaded? Might they have ties to intelligence?
Well, I've heard that that's possible about Sotloff, but I haven't heard any indication about that about Foley. But I didn't know of either of them before this happened at all, and I don't know all about
right.
it. Now we got to go again, but thanks.
Hey,
all Scott Horton here. I want to tell you about this great new book, Livin' La Vida Baroka, American Culture in an Age of Imperial Orthodoxies by Thomas Harrington. While he comes from the left, Harrington has little time for much of what is passed off under that label today. Like us libertarians, he puts peace and freedom first. The book's got great essays on American fascism, empire, the Israeli occupation, the left and Obama, liberalism and the state, and some interesting lessons from the history of Imperial Spain. Livin' La Vida Baroka by Thomas Harrington. Check it out at scotthorton.org/books or scotthorton.org/Amazon. All right, well, thanks, everybody, for calling in so far. I think it's been real good. We got one more hanging on the line. I'll give you the number again, 512-271-4836. We're mostly talking about the new World War. Well, the new Iraq War. You guys can ask whatever questions you want or make whatever statements you want. I wanted to say real quickly here, before we go to the next caller, I wanted to address what the caller was asking about, just how much of a American-controlled phenomenon is this ISIS. And, you know, I think what it is it's backdraft. It's a blowback, but much more immediate and much more obvious. And I got to tell you, I concede because, hell, I've been sitting right here saying the very thing since 2011, that it's treason, it's madness, it's absolutely crazy for America to be supporting the armed rebellion in Syria. In any way, these guys are sworn bin Ladenites. They always have been since the beginning. And for them to pretend for a moment, just because this is what Israel and Saudi and whoever else wants, to be rid of Assad, to pretend for a moment that that the Assad government is America's enemy rather than a bunch of sworn bin Ladenites, and to follow a policy that in effect helps them. Everything that they give to the FSA ends up in the hands of the jihadists, and it's been this way for years. So, and where it's not Obama's direct hands-on, it's still our satellite states, the Saudis, the Qataris, and the Turks doing it. And in the past, I've had even people like Flint Leverett and other former CIA types. I don't know if Giraldi's agreed with this, but Leverett said, yeah, it's simply plausible deniability. It's America's policy to allow this to continue. Who cares if they're bin Ladenites? Let them fight it out with Assad. That's Israeli policy and Saudi policy, so that's American policy. And it's, in effect, it's high treason. I mean, it's absolutely out of control. Now, the degree of denial of the people in Washington, D.C. who've been pushing this policy this whole time, since the so-called Arab Spring broke out in its Syrian chapter here, it's hard for me to understand, much less explain. You know, I think that there's a lot of just outright doublethink. A lot of people who believe their own nonsense about, well, should have backed the moderates more sooner, and these kind of outs, you know, escape route kind of arguments. But this is absolutely America's Frankenstein monster. Whether anyone intelligent deliberately did this, I think, is really doubtful. But it's within the realm of possibility that, I mean, the plan clearly was, let's take Iran down a peg by taking Syria down a peg. Too bad George Bush gave 2/3 of Iraq to Iran. So, well, at least we can try to take Syria away from them. That was the thinking, and they admitted it. Obama said as much to Corporal Goldberg in The Atlantic in 2012. The article is called, "As President, I Don't Bluff. Goldberg, Obama, Atlantic. Don't bluff." And then there he is. They agree. Yeah, this will help weaken Iran if we can hurt Syria. Blah, blah, blah. The president's own words for you right there. And anyone else, call in 512-271-4836. Hey, I'm Scott. You're on.
Hey, Scott. How you doing?
I'm doing real good. How are you?
Good, good. Great interaction, by the way. I really enjoy listening to other callers.
Yeah, me too. This has been fun, huh?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Keep it up. You know, my thought was, you know, regardless of, you know, the creation of this group, you know, really, it's such a war of the mind as far as the Americans are concerned. You couldn't buy a PR package like these guys are getting. You know what I mean? It's, you know, they're spreading the photos and the verbiage, and it's reaching so many people, you know, including a generation of kids. You know, they're coming up and, you know, it's almost like they're being radicalized.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Sure. I mean, that's part of the, just the effect of having this so-called war against terror go on for all these years and all these years. You know, it's generations go by in 10 years when you're talking about Islamist fighters, you know, rather than 20. We're changing them out quickly, and you see people all across Europe. You know, it's just more and more people for longer and longer periods of time have the choice put before them. Who are you really loyal to? What's most important to you? And so, you know, the young and angry and testosterone filled and disaffected, you know, there's a certain profile of people within that subset who are going to go and join up, or even more scary, stay and join up with the other side in the war. And,
right.
You know, there's,
you know, what I was, you know, as far as terror is concerned, you know, it's really coming from the media. You know, they're spreading terror. You know, I saw something earlier about the subways and, you know, the threats on the New York subways. You know, people are just freaked out. And that terror is really being spread by the media, even more so than this group.
Right. Yeah, no, absolutely. Because, hey, it's in their interest to spin it that way, to always agree with the government about what must be done and then to make the best case for it. And, you know, the sad truth is, like you're saying, what PR geniuses the Islamic State are, guys are, and how receptive an audience they have to work with here already. The Americans are just playing right into, you know, those scripts just perfectly. And,
yeah, it's amazing how quickly some accounts get blocked, you know, on social media. You know, these guys are just out there, and it's like they're not being stopped. They're not being watched. I'm sure they're being watched, but it's just bizarre to me. It makes no sense that they're able to go out there and spread information like they do.
Yeah. Well, and, you know, the American people are a puzzle to me, too, because a year ago it was said that we got to go bomb Syria because we love the Syrians so much. We got to protect them from their government that's using gas on them. That was what they said. And the people said, nah, screw the Syrians. We don't care enough about them
right.
to bomb them, basically, which was good enough for me. Fine. If that's how cynical
and
mean you got to be about it to spare them, then fine. But then in this case, I guess it's, you know, a few white guys on film now being beheaded here. Is that all that it takes to make the difference, or it's just like a matter of whim? They're promised that your sons won't have to go. Only the robots are going. Only the F-18 pilots who couldn't possibly be shot down are going, and it's all fun and games to them. Don't worry. And so, you know, I guess it's that easy to just get people to say. And I'm here to tell you that these Islamic State guys, I mean, they are just Al-Qaeda in Iraq, and we've seen how they are since 2004. Really, especially
you know,
2005, they're mean sons of bitches. They always have been. They will come up with atrocities for your cameras for their own purposes and for
ours. And they're also, you know, all you really see is a parade recently. You know, I haven't seen any combat videos or anything like that, besides the beheadings, and which I really haven't seen. But the thing is, you know, you constantly see them, as the other gentleman said, you know, in their trucks with flags and guns in the air. I mean, you see them in poses. It's just the most...
Well,
really
most of that is just, yeah, it's the same file footage from the fall of Mosul and the fall of Tikrit and whatever from back in June is what they're showing there. And, well, and part of that is because journalists aren't safe around there at all, you know? And so there's... Nobody's even trying to get an interview with Baghdadi. He's not available, you know? And nobody wants to get anywhere near there. So that's another big problem here. I don't, you know, I should be watching Al Jazeera more. They may be doing a little bit better, but.
Right. Well, I appreciate it. Keep up the good work.
Thanks very much.
And,
I appreciate it.
Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah, happy to.
Absolutely. Take care.
The rest of you guys, anybody else wants to call in? We've still got, well, we got hardly any time for this segment, but I'm going to take one or two more calls in the next segment, too. It's 512-271-4836. And listen, I share y'all's cynicism in this. I mean, I'm an individualist, so at the end of the day, these guys are going to do what they're going to do. Prince Bandar and Prince Obama can give them all of our tax money in the world that they want, but that doesn't mean that they really control them. Doesn't even mean that they make good bets whatsoever on what's going to happen. I think, for example, I think it's possible that they really did not foresee ISIS blowing back into Iraq in this manner at all. I mean, we even saw the early parts of it a year ago and last January, but still not even Coburn was really saying, here comes the fall of Mosul, right? So they're really just making a damn mess.
Hey, Al Scott here for Whole Food Multicomplete at WholeFoodComplete.com. Whole Food Multicomplete is an entire supplement program in one bottle, containing 100% RDA of vitamins and minerals, plus live probiotics, digestive enzymes, antioxidant herbs, energy nutrients, and more. It's made in America using real foods and live probiotics. No chemical synthetics. It's soy-free, gluten-free, and independently tested and verified. They're so sure you'll love it, they're taking 20% off your first order with coupon code Scott Horton. Satisfaction is guaranteed at WholeFoodComplete.com.
All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. Final segment here on the show, Scott Horton Show. It's my show. Anybody wants to call in the numbers, 512-271-4836. I think it's been pretty good, right? Doing the phone calls. You guys like it, chat room guys? Like hearing the calls, doing the calls? Yeah, I think it's going pretty good. Help make up for the fact that I don't have any guests today, except Steven Zunis, who was right on. Again, bad news. I am not going to be here tomorrow. It'll be a rerun, maybe of this. But I'll be back on Monday. Oh, that also means I'm skipping the KPFK show on Sunday, too. So, sorry about that. Maybe they'll do a replay. I don't know. Anyway. If they did, it'd be good enough. It's, Tom Woods' interview of me is what I ran on KPFK last Sunday, and I did my best to make the case against the war, man. So, I don't know. I guess I'd be happy if they replayed that. I don't know if they would. Anyway, that'd be cool. Let me say real quick here, the killer cops. In Ferguson, the fix is in. There's a journalist named Dana Milbank at the Washington Post, and he's written, I think, two important pieces on this, and it's about how what the prosecutor, the DA in Ferguson, is doing, and everybody knows it, and they've announced it and talked about it, and at least the black population of Ferguson is absolutely against it and is demanding that he resign in their super majorities, I think, consensus. Demanding that he resign and let some kind of special prosecutor take over this case or something, recuse himself from this specific case, I guess. Anyway, he's not doing it, but here's what he's done. He took all the data and he said, here you go, grand jury, you decide what to do. In other words, in every other case, he gets up there and he presents to them a case. Here's why I want to prosecute this guy. Let me prosecute him. Here's my, you know, perfunctory prosecution. Here's my first draft prosecution. Why I think I can get a conviction here. Do you agree? All right, come on. Give me that indictment then. And then they give him the indictment. That's how it works. In this case, he goes, I don't know, guys. And he just hands them all of it and says, you guys decide. You guys go through all this in whatever order you want. And you figure it out. And is not seeking to do his job. Now, in a way, he's saying, hey, see, I don't have to recuse myself. I'm giving it to the grand jury to decide. It's all on them. But in the actual workings of the case, what he's really doing is sabotaging it. That's what he's doing. The same as in the case of the Walmart killing, murder, where the cops came and murdered the guy for holding a BB gun. It doesn't point at anybody. It's just pointing at the ground. He dropped it, I think, before they even shot him, or maybe after the first shot. And then they kept shooting him. And in that case, I read the bit of the local news for you on the show yesterday where the prosecutor, in other words, says He got up there and made the defense case. Yeah, I showed them what a real gun looks like compared to that toy gun, and I did this and I did that, and he explains how he went up there and explained away the police shooting of this young man to the grand jury. And then, surprise, they agreed with him that these cops should be no-billed for shooting a guy with a toy gun he was going to buy at the Walmart he was in. Which, as a guest on TV last night pointed out, sells real rifles. What if he bought a real rifle? Does that mean if a black man buys even a toy rifle or a real rifle, which are legal in America, at any Walmart, that he's fair game to be murdered? To be outright, just have his head blown off by whatever cop feels like it? I mean, what is this? It's sabotage is what it is. It's the proof, again, that there's no rule of law. That's just make pretend. Those are just the excuses so the government can do whatever they want with you if and when they feel like it. But the law doesn't apply to the government. That's the greatest myth the devil ever sold the American people, is that our government employees are just citizens, just like us, and are subject to the law, just like us. No, they are not. There, I win the argument. No, they are not. And they know it, which is even worse. Which is why each and every cop is just looking for his first opportunity to try to kill somebody. That's the other case. South Carolina, this cop actually got fired for local PR reasons. I don't know. I'm amazed. They say they're even charging him with shooting this guy. The guy lived. You can't let him live to testify against you. Lesson learned. Rule number one of police academy. You're all in a hurry to try to shoot somebody. Make sure you kill him. Otherwise, you might get in trouble. And so in this case, the cop says, give me your driver's license. So the guy says, okay, and he turns around to get his driver's license out of his car, and the cop just starts shooting him. Luckily, as someone on Twitter wrote to me earlier, luckily the cop is such a bad shot, the guy lived, and so now the cop's in trouble. They're just looking for the chance to shoot somebody because they know they can't get in trouble. You know, the fact that this one cop in South Carolina is getting in trouble doesn't prove I'm wrong. It proves I'm right, because he's the exception that proves the rule. Like we had a news story just a few weeks back about how in Florida, no cop has been prosecuted for killing anyone in decades. In decades. The law in Florida is the cops can murder whoever they feel like at any time. You think the cops don't know that none of them have been prosecuted for killing anybody in decades? Yeah. That's only news to us. Jeez, really? It's almost like those cops are all angels, or the people of Florida are all devils, or maybe our system doesn't work. Anyway, something to keep in mind. Oh, and then another one. This one's in the New York Times. You gotta read this. It's incredible. In Mississippi, where there's no due process of law whatsoever, people get arrested and they get held sometimes in solitary confinement in the local jail without a hearing, without a lawyer, without a grand jury, without nothing, for just as long as it takes, actually with a grand jury, but as long as they take to finally get it together. And in some cases, as documented in the story, they didn't even know that these people weren't even on the grand jury schedule ever. They're just sitting in jail with no lawyer, no hearing, no chance to even ask what the hell at all. They're held in local jail in indefinite detention without charges. And then the judge says, well, yeah, what am I going to do? I'm going to provide a defense attorney to somebody who's not even necessarily been charged and may not end up being charged. Well, yeah, if they're sitting in jail like it's a prison sentence on misdemeanor, would be misdemeanor charges for years in America now in Mississippi. And of course, yes, mostly blacks because they have no political power. And so the government is like a pit bull off his leash when it comes to them. But, you know, poor white people, too. The state is merciless. I mean, they're racist, too, but they don't see skin color. There's, you're either on the government team or you're on the other side of the thin blue line, which means you're prey. Simple as that. You know, people think class issues in America is all about billionaires and this and that. It's true, the billionaires are lawless. Don't get me wrong. Look at Eric Holder's biography for how lawless they are. But the government, the lowliest cop has as much impunity as the most famous movie star on trial. The most famous pro athlete. The richest billionaire. The lowliest cop has as much immunity and impunity as them. Not that it's fair that they do. But at least there you can explain it that, like, hey, the most talented lawyers cost a hell of a lot, and only the very richest can afford them. That's not necessarily corrupt. That's just the breaks. They eat the best tasting steaks, too, you know? That's just how that goes. But where cops just basically all have a get-out-of-jail-free card no matter what for killing anyone they want. Maybe that always was the law in America, but to me, it's at least new the degree to which we see it. Maybe it's just the changes in the media. Day in, day out, cops kill people, no reason, no problem. The other day in Atlanta, I think this one was in Atlanta, I was a 14-year-old boy yesterday. Right after the show was over, I saw it. 14-year-old boy killed by a cop. They all have been hanging out in this abandoned house for more than a year. Nothing scandalous or criminal or suspicious about it. It was just the kids playing in the neighborhood in this old house. Cop came in the door, put a bullet in his heart. 14-year-old boy. See you tomorrow. I mean, it's Monday.